Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel will deliver a lecture this week in Louisville. We'll talk with Martin Indyk ahead of his trip. First, Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear demanded a thorough review of the 1990 Kentucky Education Reform Act in his State of the Commonwealth address earlier this month. And education is the focus of Senate Bill 1, which is now a weighty topic among Kentucky's legislators and educators. It would revamp Kentucky's student testing system, known as the Commonwealth Accountability Testing System, or CATS, and abandon written parts of the test. The bill passed the state Senate earlier this month, and this week the House of Representatives is expected to offer its take on overhauling student testing. Some of the proposed changes have arts educators concerned, including Tanya Bromley. She's the president of the Kentucky Music Educators Association. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with her about the legislation and her concerns.
What is the state of arts education in Kentucky today, and are there differences between how it's applied in metropolitan and rural school districts?
In most areas of the state, you'll find band programs, choral programs in the high school, middle school levels, although those programs right now are a little bit being challenged by some of the pressures in scheduling, those kind of things. But we have some very good orchestra programs. Montgomery County, Eastern Kentucky around Ashland has excellent string programs. Owensboro schools have some outstanding school programs. So there's pockets around in addition to the metropolitan areas of Lexington and Louisville.
How is the arts covered in the Commonwealth Accountability Testing System, which is also known as CATS?
The CATS system, as we know it, is designed to give a score that will tell how a school's doing. It's not the kind of test that's going to give people some real information for how to improve instruction or how to help a student improve. And it's generally focused on arts concepts which can be measured. At present, some of those tests are deficient at really measuring artistic cognitive skills, like the test in music has no listening on it. So that's one thing that needs to be improved in the test to make an arts test of real cognitive artistic skills that students should have. Skills in listening, actually deciphering what a piece of art looks like, or watching a dance and giving information back on what type of the dance that is. And that's where we need to work, is assessment that can be measured by paper pencil, and also assessment that gives us back information on how students are doing, not on how teachers are doing based on what students answer.
Well, then, what is the intention of Senate Bill 1?
Senate Bill 1 is saying, let's cut down on the overall massive amount of testing we're doing, and let's make sure that the testing we're doing has real meaning in terms of giving feedback to parents and students and teachers in order to improve instruction and in order to remediate students where they have shortcomings.
Some people have said that they're concerned about Senate Bill 1 and that it will harm arts education. How would that play out?
Schools are graded by their School Accountability Index. That score really determines how successful a school is, and in many cases, you know, principals, administrators are going to be held accountable for how well their school scored on all of the CATS tests. In Senate Bill 1, as it's now worded, schools will still be judged on how students perform on written tests. And the arts have between 5 and 7% of that pie, depending on whether they're elementary, middle, or high school. Now, Senate Bill 1 takes written tests out of the arts and does not make a provision then for supplanting that percentage of the score. If a school is in trouble, they say our scores are not good, we're having some financial difficulties. Well, the arts don't count in our score anymore, and the score is what counts. So we're going to do away with our arts program, and maybe we'll come back and pick it up later. Well, you know what happens there. Now, the flip side of that is that what is proposed is that in its place is a program evaluation, a program. So each school should have to be responsible for completing a program evaluation of how effective their arts programs are for kids. And this is a real positive thing of Senate Bill 1, because what it does is it gives schools credit for having robust arts programs that are having students participate in performances and showing evidence of students creating, and that's the top layer of where that basic cognitive knowledge comes into play. You have to have the basic cognitive skills and understandings, which we can measure on pencil and paper, but those don't measure the whole program. And right now in the current CATS test, there's no credit given for performing or creating. And so what a lot of schools are doing, in some small cases, we are beginning to see evidence of schools turning over the job of music education back to the classroom teacher who can teach terms only. Our position as Kentucky music educators is those things that can be measured in terms of individual student performance should be measured and should give parents feedback and should be part of the school accountability index just like any other core subject that's being assessed. The problem with Senate Bill 1 is we just need to fix some language and we need to keep some level of individual student assessment in there.
And how are legislators receiving these concerns about Senate Bill 1, especially as it pertains to arts education, and what are their prevailing attitudes about arts education?
I must say that legislators have been very willing to listen to us, and we're not against the basic precept of the bill. I think we're making headway in the right direction, but removing the written test can have some consequences of not maintaining standards for the arts, which we do have now in Kentucky, and we still need to be working towards some sort of standards-based kind of assessment, and we don't want to go backward there.
So where do you hope that 10 years from now arts education is in Kentucky?
That every elementary child in this state has an opportunity to study the arts with teachers who are specialized in an art form, and that time is being protected for the study of the arts, not use of the arts in the curriculum, not study about the arts, so that we can help kids find their best artistic avenue of expression. Look up Mike Huckabee. When he was governor of Arkansas, there was an elementary music and art specialist in every school in that state, and the time was protected for it. It can be done. We have to want it bad enough. You know, the Kathleen Battle or Joshua Bell may be in the most underserved economic area we have. You know, we think that we've got to train our doctors and our lawyers. We need to find our artists and nurture them through our public schools because they're going to be the ones that are going to record our culture for the next generation.
Well, thank you very much for being with
sure.
us.
Martin Indyk is a widely respected authority on the Middle East. Indyk, a native of England who was educated in Australia, has twice held the post of U.S. Ambassador to Israel, appointed in 1995 and again in 2000 by President Bill Clinton. His second stint on the job extended 6 months into the administration of George W. Bush. Indyk, who's now the director of the Sabin Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, has written a book about his experiences as a diplomat and Middle East expert. It's called Innocent Abroad, an intimate account of American peace diplomacy in the Middle East. Indyk will deliver a lecture this week at the Louisville Free Public Library. I spoke to Indyk about his new book and the Middle East challenges facing President Barack Obama. Well, let's start with the title. How did you decide on the main title of the book, Innocent Abroad?
Well, I struggled with it for a long time, but what struck me as I got to writing the epilogue about the Bush administration's approach, because most of the book is about the Clinton administration's approach to peacemaking in the Middle East, that there was an unusual commonality. Even though Clinton tried to make the Middle East over as a more peaceful place, and Bush tried to make the Middle East over as a more democratic place, and they adopted very different means for doing so. Nevertheless, the commonality lay in a certain innocence that both administrations showed in their efforts to transform the Middle East, and it's an innocence that manifests itself in this belief that we have an obligation to change this troubled region, an assumption that we have the solutions, that we can in fact make the Middle East over in our own image, and a certain there's a certain arrogance that goes with that, and naivete, or even ignorance of the local conditions and the culture and history of the region that makes it so different. And it's there, the interaction between our innocence and their cynicism, that leads to America always somehow getting tripped up and dragged down into the swamps of that region.
Seems like every new administration comes in with a new sense of optimism about making things right over there.
Well, indeed. When I wrote the book, I tried to draw the lessons of our failures during the Clinton years for the next effort by a president to make peace in the Middle East. I didn't know at the time that Barack Obama would announce on day two of his administration that he was going to renew the effort to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict, and of course he appointed George Mitchell as his special envoy for that purpose. And so the lessons of the past failures become very important in terms of what President Obama is now trying to do.
What's your impression of President Obama's knowledge of the various scenarios he'll have to deal with in the Middle East?
Well, what's striking to me about President Obama is that he has a combination of a humility and a instinct for how to deal with the people of the region. And both are very important. I think both Clinton and Bush, in their very different ways, tried to transform the region. He has, I think, a more realistic expectations of what can be achieved. But on the other side, in contrast with George Bush, and much like Bill Clinton, he understands that it's very important to show respect for the other, to listen and not just try to dictate our approach, and to demonstrate an understanding of the difficulties of trying to move this region towards peace.
What do you think about his appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State?
Well, I'm biased in that regard. I'm a Clintonista, and I worked for her during her campaign.
Yes.
I was advising her on the Middle East and hoped that she would be president. So naturally, I think it's a great appointment. She's very effective, knowledgeable, serious, and tough. And I think those are all very good elements in of a Secretary of State who wants to use diplomacy to try to resolve many of the conflicts that we face around the world. So I think it's a very powerful team of Obama, Clinton, and Mitchell that may make up for some of the immense difficulties they're going to face in trying to crack this conflict.
There's been talk of striking up, for lack of a better term, striking up a dialogue with Iran. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's very important, again, learning the lessons of the past. We tried in the Clinton years to resolve the Arab-Israeli conflict while isolating Iraq and Iran, because we judged them, I think correctly, as two regimes that were hostile to our interests and our friends and allies in the region, particularly the Gulf Arabs. So in those days, it was a policy of comprehensive peace and what we call dual containment, or containment of Iran. And what the Iranians figured out in those days was that the way they could thwart our strategy of isolating them was to trip us up in the peace process. And they used their proxies in those days, Hezbollah and Palestine Islamic Jihad, now they have Hamas, to basically put a stick in our spokes and very successfully disrupted through violence and terrorism our peacemaking efforts. This time around, what Obama is saying is we're going to try to pursue comprehensive peace between Arabs and Israelis, particularly with Israel and Syria, which is allied to Iran, but at the same time we're going to say to Iran, We're not trying to isolate you. If you want to be part of this new, more peaceful order in the Middle East, the door is open. If you want to isolate yourself, then that is your choice. And I think that is a more effective way of trying to deal with the potential Iranian opposition to our efforts to make peace.
Now, you're going to be coming to Louisville next week to talk about your book. How has the book been received, generally speaking?
Well, there's been some very good reviews, and it's caused quite a bit of a stir in the Middle East, particularly in Israel, because I say some things about Israeli leaders that are not convenient at a highly political time in Israel. I was very flattered. George Mitchell, I saw him the other day, said that he'd taken the book on his last visit to the Middle East, and he was surprised to see members of his team also pulled out the book when they got into the plane and were reading it. So that's very gratifying, because I think that it's really important now that we have a president who's trying again to make peace, that he take account of what went wrong the last time we tried.
Well, the name of the book is Innocent Abroad, an Intimate Account of American Peace Diplomacy in the Middle East. Ambassador Martin Indyk, thanks for joining us this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Martin Indyk is a former U.S. ambassador to Israel. He'll speak at the main Louisville Free Public Library Tuesday night at 7. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer has information on a church-based art series. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Gabe Buller talks with Louisville adventurer Tori Merden McClure about her upcoming book release. First, many local churches have mounted art exhibitions or put on concerts for parishioners and the public at large. Now, Christ Church Episcopal Cathedral is initiating ongoing events it's calling Cathedral Arts, including a concert this afternoon. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with the cathedral's Reverend Mark Berlakis.
Today you're having an event called Spiritual Mardi Gras, which is part of the Cathedral Arts. Tell me a little bit about this event and how it fits into the arts program at the church.
I've been there 2 years, and what we're looking to do now through Cathedral Arts, which used to just be music only, is to expand that to the visual arts as well, to include poetry. And so we're looking for different ways to bring people of various different faiths or people who are of no faith to the cathedral for different kinds of events. And so today, as we approach the season of Lent, which is traditionally a period of celebration, which Mardi Gras gets its name from, Fat Tuesday, we were thinking of ways that we might have a little bit of a meditative time that wasn't quite Lenten, but might draw people into a preparation for the season. Having poetry readings by Ron Seitz and Penny Sisto, and then in between those readings, what we're calling tone poems for vibraphone, double bass, and percussion. Dick Sisto, Jeremy Allen, and Jason Tiemann doing that, and we'll have some wine and cheese after it, which will be nice, sort of a celebratory thing right before Lent begins.
How does this fit into understanding the religious season coming up?
It's a kind of preface to the holy season of Lent, in which people are partying before they have to sort of do these traditionally prayerful or setting aside things like whatever it might be, chocolate or alcohol. So what we wanted to do was to see if there was a way to give a spiritual sense to it, and we use the word spiritual intentionally, that it's not religious, but it's more spiritual in the sense that it's contemplative or reflective, which gives people time still within the season of Mardi Gras, but just on the cusp of preparing for a holy season. So in that way, it brings those two parts of the culture together. Instead of sort of wild drinking and parade going, there is perhaps this reflective time prior to the season beginning.
And this is part of a larger program called Cathedral Arts. Why is art important to the faith community, and what do you hope it achieves?
We hope it does two things. The church has always been traditionally a patron of the arts, whether it's been for the production of buildings or stained glass or pipe organs or any number of ways that artisans have been involved. The church was the way that those artists earned their living. we'd like to revive, as a lot of churches would like to do, but we'd like to revive that tradition of being a patron of the arts. And then to the second part of your question, which is sort of why now and what we hope to do with this particular program or thing that we call Cathedral Arts, is to provide a place where we can sponsor and be a part of arts activities that may, in some cases, have some overlap with the religious community or the spiritual lives of people, but in other cases may just engage their aesthetic senses, which the church, in the best of religious art, has done. So we may have any number of things, from art openings of paintings or photography, which we have an exhibit of photography opening a couple months from now, draw people in to the church, which used to be a sort of wide open place that sponsored any number of events. And we want to be both house of prayer for all people, of many different religious backgrounds, not even Christian. We've had Muslims and Buddhists and worshiping at the cathedral, and we want to broaden that base, but also a place where, especially being a downtown church, where we can engage the downtown and the culture at large with the arts and be a part of the arts community.
And what do you hope it does for the church over time?
As people see us as an inclusive, open, welcoming community, to come to know us beyond our Episcopal denominationalism, know us as a friend of downtown, and we give our people an opportunity to serve and be hospitable and hosts to a wide variety of religious expressions, have their religious horizons broadened.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Louisvillian Tory Merton McClure has skied, climbed, and paddled in, around, and across places where very few people have before. She has skied to the South Pole, climbed the Lewis Nanatuck in Antarctica, and rode a boat across the Atlantic. Gabe Buller talked with McClure about her new book, which details her first and ultimately failed attempt to paddle across the ocean, and the events that convinced her to complete that journey.
This was your second trip across, or second attempt.
Well, the book... Actually, about three-quarters of the book is about my first attempt, my failed attempt to row across the ocean. And I hadn't intended to take almost 8 years to write the book. And yet, it's proving it to be quite timely because it is essentially a story of failure and recovery from failure and all the magical people that entered my life at various times after I'd fallen down and lifted me back up. And certainly with the row itself, the great fall after my failed row, and then going to work for Muhammad Ali and having Muhammad Ali pick me up and say, you know, you don't want to grow through life as the woman who almost rowed across the ocean. And so I retell that story and then go. The successful row is almost an also-ran in the book. It's very quick. It's maybe 20 pages out of a 300-page book. And how that happened was I was writing. And the interesting story, the story that I learned the most from, the really challenging part of my two rows was the first row. And facing Hurricane Danielle and almost being pummeled to death. And then coming back to Louisville between the rows and falling in love with the man who's now my husband really make the story complete. And my agent, who read the book in its somewhat longer form, said, you know, Tori, you had to row across the ocean twice. The reader does not. And so I ended up cutting out most of the second row.
Do you think when you look at that span in your life or that time in your life from the first row to the completion of the second row that your memories are the way that they're laid out in the book, where most of them are about the first row and the aftermath there?
I think the great lessons that I learned were mostly from the first row. The story of the book, the superficial story is, you know, took a rowboat to the ocean, a lot of rowing, storm, rowing, storm. And it's kind of the classic hero quest story of you have a goal, you set out to achieve it, there are pitfalls along the way. There are challenges that set you back. And there are mentors and guides who influence how it comes out in the end. Well, being a woman, the classic hero quest is not, it's not a feminine tale. It's sort of the manly male tale. And I kept writing and rewriting and rewriting and kept sort of bumping into the notion of what makes it important is I'm not a man. And yet this drive, this quest has been part of my life. And it has nothing to do with rowing across oceans. It has to do with a much more challenging element, and that is sort of an ongoing battle against helplessness. And I might be about the last person in Louisville, Kentucky that folks would say, oh, she's helpless. But the memoir elements of the book that are inserted from childhood and my teenage years and early adulthood are all about kind of going up against injustice, working with homeless people, working with adjudicated teenagers, working with developmentally disabled people, and running into prejudices and hurtful things that I couldn't change, running into people who really needed help and I couldn't help them. And that sense of draining helplessness that robs you of compassion. And what I wanted to do and what kept sending me to the backcountry was this sense of recharging. I'd bump my head into the brick wall 1,000 times and I'd be pretty beaten up. And then I'd go into the backcountry and remember how to build endurance and resourcefulness and persistence and all the things that you learn from a backcountry journey or the hero quest, and then try to bring them back to civilization. And ultimately, in the second row, I'm out there and I've rowed 3,000 miles. It looked like I was going to set a new record for the fastest solo crossing. Not the fastest solo crossing for a woman, but the fastest solo crossing. And another hurricane formed. And here I am in another storm, wondering if I'm going to live. And I had the one passage in the book that I don't think I'll ever have it just quite right. I wrote exactly what happened, but I go out on deck in the height of the storm and I'm just screaming at God, saying, what do you want from me? I have done everything you put in my path to do. You know, I've worked in the hospitals. I've worked on the street. I've done all these things. What do you want from me? And knowing that my entire being was geared toward, you know, if I row across the ocean, that'll prove I'm not helpless. If I can do this thing, then I won't feel weak and I won't feel stupid and I won't feel small. And when people in front of me need my help, I'll be able to help. And I'm in the middle of this storm shouting at God. And it was like this great epiphany for me. The sublime moment comes and I realize, wait a minute, I can row to the moon. I will still be a human being. And what it means to be a human being is that we are flawed. And there are moments when we just can't make things work out right. And the only thing that makes that reality bearable is love. And love was one element that I had sort of barred from my life because of some tragic things that happened early on in my life. And I just, you know, love was not for me. Love was for other people. I had things to do. I was busy. And in that storm and in that moment, recognized that I had been closing the doors to a really important factor in what it means to be a human being. And so the title of the book changed quite recently. It had a number of different titles. The most troubling title was the one that it almost was going to be published with, and it was I Had to Row Across the Ocean, which, according to the Barnes & Noble representative, made it sound like a stupid jock book. And she all but demanded that the publisher change the title, and they did change the title to A Pearl in the Storm. Now, my boat was named the American Pearl, so it works on a literal level, but it also works on a metaphorical level. All the people who were the pearls in my storms, and all the times that we need to be the pearls in other people's storms, especially now.
On that metaphorical level, it seems like the whole story is kind of full of these real events that function also, if they were in a work of fiction, as incredibly symbolic elements.
Yes, and someone asked me to describe the book once, and I took this attention, and I said, it's almost as if I have rewritten the tale of Moby Dick. I was Ahab, and my Moby Dick was this sense of weakness, this sense of helplessness, and I wanted to kill it. And I spent all this time trying to kill helplessness, and then ultimately realized that helplessness is just part of who we are, and that in the book, I think I write something like, you know, rather than slay my dragons, I realized I had to embrace them.
How do you think that's changed your life afterwards?
Well, there are days when I still very much do battle with helplessness. And I work as a vice president at Spalding University, and it's an outstanding institution for somebody like me, because there are lots of students and lots of faculty who are in that same battle. You know, it's like I'm not fighting the battle alone anymore. There are students who come because they want to make a difference in their lives. They want to make a difference in other people's lives. Most of our academic tracks are service-oriented tracks, like, you know, the classic Spalding nurse or this classic Spalding teacher. I don't think there's a public school in Jefferson County that doesn't have someone who was trained at Spalding University. And they're going out and they're making a difference. And it's that making a difference that is engaging in that battle against helplessness.
That was Tori Merton McClure. Her book, A Pearl in the Storm, will be released in April. When we come back, church organs are making a comeback, and Elizabeth Kramer gets to the bottom of it. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, Robin Fisher talks with writer Lauren Groff about her collection of short stories, Delicate Edible Birds. First, Amy Grant propelled contemporary Christian music to the top of the music charts in the 1980s and paved the way for the praise bands of the next decade. They're the ones with guitars, drums, and other modern instruments that some churches incorporated into their services. Now, congregations across the country and in Louisville are refocusing on traditional instruments, specifically the organ. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
Organist Dan Stokes and two organ builders are checking out a notable instrument in Old Louisville's Central Presbyterian Church. This organ with around 2,500 pipes was built in 1930 by Ernest Skinner, a prominent organ builder of the early 20th century.
This is the French horn stop.
Some notes are very dirty, but it sounds very different than the one.
Michel Godbout works for a Canadian organ company.
Our artistic director, he heard the sound of the French horn here, so he want me to make about the same sound that he heard. So I just want to hear the sound here, take some measurement.
Godbout and a colleague heard about this organ while in town installing a new one at Christ Church United Methodist, where Stokes works. After climbing inside the organ at Central Presbyterian, we head out to Brownsboro Road to Christ Church, where Stokes is music director. The organ here cost about $1 million and takes up a whole wall of the new sanctuary. While the organ builders are inside this organ making some last-minute adjustments, Stokes and I go behind it to a ladder.
You want to go up?
Sure.
Godbout's colleague, Martin Côté, helps me.
If you want, you can count the pipes.
How many pipes are in here?
3,000.
Stokes sees the beauty of this organ inspiring parishioners to participate in creating moving church music, which he contrasts to the guitar-oriented praise bands that gained popularity in churches in the 1980s.
Organists and church musicians like me killed church music. And it became so about the performance, and people felt like, I can't really participate because I'm not good enough.
Stokes says that's changing now, and so does Tony Thurman of the American Guild of Organists.
What we've seen over the past decade, I believe, in Louisville is a real renewed interest in the organ, a renewed interest in bringing new instruments to the Louisville community and bringing musicians to play them.
Another new organ in town is at Christ Church Episcopal Cathedral downtown. This standalone instrument that can be moved around the sanctuary has 325 pipes. Music director Robert Bozeman says many people are attached to the organ's traditional and spiritual sound and many Protestant churches are investing in organs.
There's this huge amount of work going on in the organ building industry. If you talk to any of the top builders, they're just booked for years.
The Associated Pipe Organ Builders of America backs that with reports of $100 million in yearly sales. But it raises the question, who will play these instruments? Over the past 20 years, the number of music students majoring in the organ has fallen more than 30%, and some prestigious music schools have closed their organ programs. Although the University of Louisville maintains its program, it has no organ majors now, says Bozeman, who teaches there. Still, he and other music directors are hoping that the work they do will draw young musicians to the instrument. It includes opening church doors to the public for concerts. And Stokes is working on that one. Now, before the new organ, he is leading the choir in an 18th century American hymn they will sing at a Sunday concert. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Lauren Groff burst onto the literary scene in 2008 with her first novel, The Monsters of Templeton. The novel quickly became a book group favorite and propelled the 30-year-old writer to the top of the literary heap. Not content to rest on her laurels, Groff has just released a new collection of short stories. Robin Fisher talked to Groff about her collection, Delicate Edible Birds and Other Stories, and the art of the short story.
As a reader, I have to get into a different mindset when I read short stories as opposed to longer pieces, novels. And I just kind of wondered, is that true for a writer?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that writing a novel and writing short stories, it's really like just using two different parts of your brain, I think. And for me, I write novels every day, sort of like marathon training. You know, you go out, you do the run. It's frequently not awe-inspiring, but, you know, the novel day after day gets done. It's short stories are sort of things that I can't not do. They're passionate things that just sort of bubble up in my head, and I have to write them at the moment that I have to write them. And usually it takes years to write a final draft of a short story. You write it once, you look at it, you realize it doesn't work, and then you start all over again some other time in the future when you're ready to attack it again.
Well, that sort of leads me into another sort of a companion question. Isn't it more difficult to write a well-crafted short story than it is a novel? I mean, let's face it, in a novel, you've got room to throw in some things that you might think, well, it's good, but it's not great. But in a short story, you have to be on it.
Well, you know, it's just different. I mean, you know, you're right. Henry James called the novel The Loose Baggy Monster. And it is in a way, but also, you know, novels have to have forward momentum. You just really have to make sure it just keeps chugging forward. And stories do have to have a very tight skeleton, very light skeleton, and structure that has to be pretty much perfect. And I think some stories, I mean, longer stories can probably have a little bit more flab. But I don't think it's any harder or less hard. I think they're so different. They call for different ways of writing. And I think a novel is incredibly hard because it takes forever to write. And short stories are incredibly fun to write because a draft, at least, you can write in one sitting. So it's fun. They're both fun.
Well, there's something, I guess I would call it quiet, but very intense about your voice throughout the book. Even though it's different from story to story, there's still something sort of simmering there, but it's quiet. You know, there's not what I would call an overwhelming sense of anger or anything. But tell me, did you pick the stories for the book from stories that you had? Did you write the stories intentionally to go together?
Yeah, no, I actually, you know, I've been writing stories for about 15 years now, and a lot of them just don't succeed when I write them. But I didn't write them to go together, though it does seem that I have preoccupations that I return to again and again. And I had about probably 30 to 40 stories that I could have chosen from and worked on in order to have them go together in the book. But what I did know is that I wanted a few thematic linkages. And the big, most unsubtle one is the idea that every story centers around a strong female character. Hence, a little bit the title, Delicate Edible Birds. And then the other few ones are, you know, there's water very important in every single story, swimming, just the feeling of water. And I think, I don't know if that was intentional when I was putting the stories together, but it does seem to be a preoccupation of mine. And another thing is obviously the birds. There are birds in every story, and some of them play a much stronger role than other birds.
Well, there's also sex in every story.
There's sex in every story, too. I know. I mean, that's something that I think that the short story does in some ways smoother than the novel, because in novels you can get all into the stickiness and, you know, sort of the John Updike-y, mechanics. And with short stories, you do have to go through them quickly. So I think a lot of people don't actually stay. I mean, I'm thinking of most stories. There are some definitely that have a lot of sex in them or are based on sex. But you're right. Nobody had ever told me that before, but that's funny.
Well, you know, I kind of want to stay on that. It was something sure. I had thought maybe I would discuss a little bit later in the interview. But your women in the book seem to have sort of an uneasy relationship with sex. It often leads to bad things. I'm thinking about Byrne in Delicate Edible Birds, which is the title story. She's a great character. She owns her own sexuality, but in the end, she has to sacrifice that.
Right.
And sort of in The Majorette, you know, there's no sex is, I don't know what I want to say about that in The Majorette. It is both her comfort and her not a weapon, but something that she sort of insulates herself with.
I think that's the way that it has been for women historically. It is something that one can use as a weapon, and one women have in the past used it as a weapon. It's also something that is very, it makes a lot of women very vulnerable. So it's a paradoxical thing that we have, and I think that's one of the things I was looking at when I was putting this story collection together, just the attitudes, especially changing over the 20th century, because most of the stories in this book take place at some point in the 20th century, which is an amazing century in terms of the way that women seen in society have developed, and especially in terms of sexuality, things like that. So you're right. It was intentional, and it's a very complicated issue. And I think that that's the beautiful thing about fiction, is that it doesn't actually answer any questions, but it does pose a whole lot of them. So I think that was what I was trying to do, just pose a lot of questions about the idea of sexuality and sex.
Well, you packed a whole lot of women's evolution, I guess I would say, in Majorette.
Yeah.
That was my favorite story in the book.
So funny.
But, just the image of, there's the image of her mother, which I'm guessing was probably in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
51, maybe, is
mm-hmm,
what it
said.
Somewhere
around there, yeah.
Teenager, pregnant, going into her first home. And then, here comes the little girl, and she is, searching for her way, sort of like women were during the 60s. Mm-hmm. In 70s, or at least mm-hmm. that's how I read it. And then, then of course her daughter is this, I am woman.
Right.
Right. I am woman and I don't even care, kind of.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
But that story was really interesting, because it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And I mean that in a good way. It was, on the one hand, full of quiet desperation, but I think maybe partially because of the title, and maybe because of how it seemed to go with the main character, you almost expect it to be a story of molestation,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it is not. I mean, it's a story of recovery.
Yeah,
more than anything. And the detail is incredible. When she's a baby and she's crawling around on the floor learning how to use her little arms, I would have thought you remembered what it was like to be a baby.
Well, thank you. I babysat a lot when I was writing this story. Well, you know, it's that generation, the generation that was born in the early 50s, came into being in the late 60s and 70s, sort of into their adulthood. They really were the revolutionary generation, I think, in a lot of ways. My mom's generation. And the way that she relates to the place in her life, the idea of womanhood in her life, and the way that I relate and the way that my grandmother does, they're very, very different. We're almost of different sexes in a lot of ways. You know, yeah, you're right. The daughter, the granddaughter of the first woman in the story, the majorette's daughter, is completely different. And the way that she deals with life is completely different. And I think that's, you know, I wrote that story out of admiration for that transitional generation.
Well, it's interesting the way that the main character, the majorette, views her daughter, because she is a little afraid of her daughter's self-power.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was very interesting because, you know, you go through the struggle as you're the transition generation, and then your daughters are what's come from that.
Right.
But they're completely alien.
In a lot of ways.
In a good way, but you know, they're completely alien, and you've really captured that in that short story.
Thanks. There's something to be said about having to struggle through and really working at it. And I think that with my generation and people younger than me, there is maybe a sense of maybe not, you know, we take it for granted in a lot of ways. And I was wondering why we did that, and that's what gave birth to the story.
Will any of the stories evolve into novels, or do you compartmentalize, or do you not know?
Well, you know, the stories announce themselves to me the way that they should be, most of the time. And, you know, I'm even talking about some of the failed novels that I've written, too. And I get to the end of a draft and think, wow, that was really bad. Maybe someday I'll take some ideas from this and put them into a short story. But usually when I get to the point where I'm going to sit down and write something, I know the basic form of the story. I know the architecture of the story. And all I have to do is really sit down and write it and figure out what the structure is, and what the voice is and who the characters are. But I know how long the story itself should be. So no, I don't think any of these are going to be a novel. But, you know, I was at this festival a little while ago, and this writer named John Burnham Schwartz, who's just wonderful, he wrote Reservation Road, but he was saying, you know, as writers, we take 5 or 6 preoccupations, and all we do for the rest of our lives is turn them around in this way and that and try to see them in a different way. And I think I will probably come back to a lot of the same preoccupations. And part of the process of writing this book was figuring out what my preoccupations actually are. And as a young writer, that's pretty interesting to know and to identify, you know, I'm writing about this yet again. You know, when in the past, I just read about what I needed to write about. So having that sort of meta idea of my writing in general is interesting, and it's strange and confusing and everything all at once.
Well, it's nice for us to be on this journey with you, Lauren. Thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
That was Robin Fisher talking with author Lauren Groff about her new short story collection, Delicate Edible Birds and Other Stories. Groff will be reading from her new book at Carmichael's Bookstore on Frankfort Avenue Tuesday evening at 7. Visit our website for more details, wfpl.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at wfpl.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Hallett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.